Hello and welcome. This is Your Calls Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Renee Kemp in today for Rose Aguilar. Thanks so much for being with us. It's going to be a fascinating hour. Today we are committing the entire hour to talking with Mother Jones award-winning investigative reporter Shane Bauer. He's here today to discuss his new book. It's called American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. For 4 months, beginning in 2014, Shane worked as a $9-an-hour prison guard at CCA, which stands for Corrections Corporation of America's facility. It's called the Wynn Correctional Center, located deep in the woods in the middle of nowhere in Louisiana. Try to get a mental picture of just that surrounding as we talk to Shane about his experience. In 2017, the company was running more than 80 facilities, everything from state prisons and jails to residential reentry facilities, and even including federal immigration detention centers. But Shane Bauer had a unique experience. It is almost unheard of for a reporter to be able to gain this kind of access, especially to today's privately owned prison. So we're particularly grateful to have you here, Shane, to talk about this experience. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you're an undercover reporter. You're an investigative reporter, I should say. And part of your experience was actually it being in Iran, and your work there had you in prison in Iran. So talk about that experience and why, for heaven's sake, after that experience, would you come back to the States and then choose a story that would put you again behind the wall?
Well, I was living in 2008-2009 in Syria, in Damascus, where I was working as a reporter. I was reporting around the Middle East, Baghdad, Fallujah, Yemen. And I took a trip with some friends to Iraqi Kurdistan. I wasn't actually reporting on this trip. We just went for a week. We were in the Kurdish area, which was considered safe for visitors and actually had a small tourist industry at the time. We went to a kind of local tourist site near Soleimaniyah, which was a waterfall, and there were a lot of kind of Kurdish families camping around there. And we hiked up a trail. We hiked quite far, and we unknowingly neared the Iran-Iraq border. We were beckoned by some soldiers who we thought were Iraqi Kurdish soldiers, and turned out they're Iranian. They detained us, and that led to a two-year saga of us essentially being used as kind of political chips between Iran and the United States.
How were the conditions?
The conditions were difficult. I was in a political prison. I was in solitary confinement for 4 months. The rest of the time was still isolated. I was in a cell with my friend, but was otherwise cut off from the outside world for the most part. We were blindfolded and we left our cells. People there were, most of them were pro-democracy activists who had been arrested for street protests. Some were tortured physically.
And how long were you there?
I was there for 26 months.
Okay, for just over 2 years.
Yeah.
So why in the world, after that experience, after being freed, would you decide to pursue a story that would put you, literally, although on the guard side of the equation, that would put you behind bars again, so to speak?
Well, I found myself getting drawn into the American prison system after I got out. It wasn't my plan. I got out of prison, came back to the U.S. I intended, actually, to go back to the Middle East. The Arab Spring was underway at the time. But when I got back to California in 2011, there was a widespread hunger strike inside California prisons. There were reports of some 30,000 inmates on hunger strike protesting the use of long-term solitary confinement.
That's the one at Pelican Bay that started at Pelican Bay, right?
Yeah, Pelican Bay. There are many around the country. These prisons are dedicated to the use of long-term solitary confinement. So the first story I did was about that, and I spent about 6 months working on this story, investigating our use of long-term solitary confinement, and was really shocked at what I found. There are people that were in solitary for 10, 20, 30, even 40 years. And after that, I got pulled deeper and deeper into the prison system. We have the largest prison system in the world by far. We have about 25% of the world's prisoners in the United States. And I kept reporting on criminal justice and the prison system and was constantly getting frustrated at the lack of access to our prisons. Even getting records from prisons is difficult. We have laws in every state that allow the public access to certain information, but in many states the corrections departments just don't comply with these laws. So even to get them to comply with a law to give us basic data, just on paper, you have to sue them. And we're not talking about getting inside of a prison. And with private prisons, the barrier is much higher because these are not public institutions, they're companies, so these laws don't even apply. So I wanted to really get a kind of up-close look at what life was like inside of these corporate-run prisons, because we hadn't had a look inside of them since they were founded in the 1980s. So I had the idea of applying for a job as a prison guard. The idea of going into a prison for me after 2 years was actually maybe it was less of a leap than maybe it was for other people. The very idea of prisons wasn't new to me.
Because of the Iran experience.
Right. Mm.
Did you find that, I think you were saying in the book, that you couldn't really penetrate from the outside because in private institutions, they consider the conditions trade secrets, right? So do you think that it's harder to penetrate the private institutions because they consider those conditions somehow proprietary? It's not the public's business?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though those are tax dollars that are being spent in these private institutions.
Right. And there have been attempts to introduce bills that would essentially make private prison companies subject to the same laws as public ones as far as access to information. And these companies lobby hard against these bills, and they have killed them every time they come up. Mm-hmm. There was one time in the course of my reporting that I was trying to find information on lawsuits that the company had settled or lost. And one way I learned to do that was to do a public records request with when the states had put out were calling for bids for running their prisons. The company in some states is required to disclose their lawsuits that they have settled. So I tried to get access to this information, and in Texas, the company intervened, saying that essentially that lawsuits about medical malpractice or prison conditions would be revealing trade secrets.
So you can't get information one way, you decide to try to get it another. So you buy a beat-up old pickup truck, mm-hmm. and you decide to go to this Louisiana facility because why? Why the Wynn Correctional Center?
Well, to be honest, it was somewhat random. When I filled out my application on the corporate website, I filled it out truthfully. I didn't lie in the application. I didn't honestly think it was going to work in the first place, but I thought, why not give it a try? And at the end of the application, you click next to what facilities you would like to send the application to. So I clicked a handful of them at random. I'd never heard of Wynn. It's not in the news. And I got phone calls from several facilities wanting to do job interviews, and Wynn was one of them. And I later learned that Wynn was the oldest medium security private prison in the country. I also was interested in Wynn compared to other prisons that I had offers from because it was in Louisiana, which at the time had the highest rate of incarceration in the world. So, I would be kind of getting into both the private prison system and this highly incarcerated system.
It was really interesting. I was getting mental pictures of the surroundings when you were describing it in the book. And it was almost like something out of a movie like Leatherface or the Chainsaw Massacre. It seemed so remote and difficult to get to and isolated in a way that would make whatever went on in there really out of the public eye. Were you scared at all?
There were times, I mean, generally I was, the fear was when I was inside the prison, but, there were times, especially when, at the end of my time there, my colleague from Mother Jones, James West, was arrested for trying to take photos of the prison, and I didn't know what they were going to do, how the sheriff was going to react, if he was going to try to arrest me for some reason. So I ended up just packing up my stuff and leaving.
But going in, did you have any concerns?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I didn't know. I remember the first time I went in there, I was really nervous. I went in for my first day of training. Part of me thought they might know already that I was a reporter, and I had all these kind of fantasies of them waiting for me. And
well, for one thing, they didn't screen you very carefully, right? So
right.
You used your real name,
yeah.
But you didn't know whether they were at some point going to just figure out who you were. Not to mention, you had all these kind of James Bondian things, like a camera hidden in an ink pen, and you're taking notes constantly.
Yeah.
And not to mention, and for the listeners, I mean, you're a slight guy. You've got pierced ears.
Yeah.
Were you afraid that they were going to say, hey, what are you doing with the what's with the pierced ears? Are you from where are you from? I mean, any of those kind of things make you nervous?
I mean, they knew that I had come from California, which already made me stand out.
Mm-hmm.
I went all the way across country for a $9 an hour job. So they, you know, people would comment on that. They would ask me, why did you come here, you know, from California? And I would just say something vague like, you never know where life's going to take you. And people generally didn't pry too much. I mean, you know, a lot of people there had backgrounds they weren't proud of. Some of the guards had been prisoners themselves. And so, you know, people kind of kept a distance.
So how quickly were you able to kind of meld in? And what did the training consist of? I think you were saying that you expected for it to last longer and be more in-depth. But instead, what did you get in the way of training?
We went through 4 weeks of training. A lot of the time was spent doing literally nothing because there were no instructors. The prison was so understaffed that the instructors often had to be working in the prison. So we would just sit and pass the day just kind of literally doing nothing and clock in and clock out. A lot of the training, you know, there were themes that would recur in training. One time in training, an instructor told us that part of our job was to deliver value to our shareholders.
Yikes.
And, you know,
okay.
This would kind of come up in terms of liability to the company. One day in training, an instructor asked us what we should do if we see two inmates fighting. And, you know, this to me is the main job of a guard, to break up fights and prevent violence between prisoners. That is kind of the idea behind the position. But the instructor told us that we were not, in fact, to get in between them, but we were simply to yell at them, stop fighting. And he said, somebody's going to win and somebody's going to lose. But what's important to us is that we go home at the end of the day, and you're not going to get paid enough to get in the middle of them. And I remember he said, if those fools want to cut each other, then happy cutting. And the idea is that, you know, if we get in the middle, we might cost the company money. We don't have any weapons. All we have is a radio. So we just kind of shout at them so that if a lawsuit comes up, you know, we can, that will be, you know, a legitimate, it will show that we were doing our jobs.
So you have no weapons. You have no gun. You have no nightstick. What do you have? Mace? Do you have anything?
No, just a radio.
Really?
Yeah.
Because why? It's a medium. Why aren't you better armed?
I mean, in most medium security prisons, guards would have pepper spray at least. But we just had radios. If we saw something happening, I saw inmates stabbing each other, and so we would call on the radio, and then there was a tactical team that would come with pepper spray. But they would almost always get there after the incident was over. But again, it was another liability issue because guards who do have pepper spray abuse it sometimes, and it can lead to lawsuits. So it's just easier for the company to just not give it to us.
Okay, so you get there, you're able to successfully blend in, despite taking notes furiously and people kind of wondering, what's he doing? You didn't get exposed. So you get a month of training, a lot of which entails nothing more than just sitting there until the time clock runs out. They tell you your job is to not get hurt at $9 an hour. They're not paying you enough to get in the middle of a fight between inmates, and that the most important thing is the shareholders. So in that case, we're talking about CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, which is this mega corporation. What did you know about them going in?
CCA is a $1.4 billion a year corporation. The industry, the entire private prison industry, is about $4 billion a year. I knew that they had started in the 1980s at a time when the prison population was just booming in America, and states were not able to build prisons fast enough. This company essentially proposed to states that it would build prisons on their own and run them cheaper. And many states accepted. So essentially the model that they came up with was one in which states would pay the company per diem. So they pay every day a price. The prison I was at, they would pay $34 a day per inmate. And the company would also be traded on the New York Stock Exchange. So it would be bringing in income that way.
And they refer to the inmates as customers. Is that right? Did I read that correct?
They did say that at one point in training, which I never quite understood, because they're not exactly paying the company. The inmates really are the commodities themselves.
Exactly, which is why it's just so cynical to even call them customers. But you said that the company, CCA, gets about $34 a day, or did at that time, per prisoner per day. And that compares to what it was costing states to publicly run these facilities. It was costing, instead of 34, it was costing 52. But the caveat was that they had to sign a contract almost guaranteeing full occupancy. Right. Now, that to me sounds, again, like just a recipe for circumstances where cops are required to make more arrests. Judges are required to find more people guilty and have longer sentences so that this full occupancy guarantee is satisfied. So, to what extent did you see the whole privatization of this process as being part of the problem?
You know, I don't know. I wouldn't say that the prison privatization is necessarily pushing people into prison. I think that it's more a symptom of the rate at which we're incarcerating people. I think the causes of mass incarceration are very complex. They have to do with, the length of sentences we're giving people, which have increased over time, criminalization of nonviolent offenses, mandatory minimums, policing, racism in American society, economic inequality. I mean, this is a massive problem. And the fact that we are putting so many people in prison, over 2 million people in prison at a given time, leads to this problem where this is a hugely expensive endeavor. And so there's inevitably going to be states are going to be looking for ways to save money, which is where the private prison industry comes in. And also, when we're imprisoning this many people, there's no way to do it in any way that is humane or leading to rehabilitation, because it costs a lot of money.
Well, certainly there are those who would argue that perhaps the private approach to this is more businesslike. The delivery of services to the customers is likely to be better. But okay, you get there. Don't know what your expectation is, but they give you your uniform, they give you a month's training, and you're out in the general population. But in some cases, what you were finding were things like excrement and open wounds not being treated. And talk a bit about the conditions once you were actually on the inside and one of the guards. What were the things that you found that kind of shocked you the most?
One of my first days inside the prison, actually my very first day when I was still in training, I met a man who was in a wheelchair who had no legs and fingers. He had lost them to gangrene. He had been begging for months to go to the hospital because he was in severe pain. And he would go to the infirmary and they would just send him back with some Motrin. And he eventually, had gangrene, had to get his legs amputated. I met a man who who was in my unit when I was working, who kept collapsing from chest pains, literally collapsing onto the floor. And they also would not send him out to the hospital. And what I learned is that when I looked at the company's contract, the contract requires that if the company sends somebody out to the hospital, they have to pay the bill. The company has to pay. So it was very reluctant to send people out. So you would see these kind of severe medical issues just kind of ignored. I also saw a lot of violence. I mean, this was the most violent prison in the state of Louisiana. And, you know, keep in mind that Louisiana prisons in general are not they're not known for their good conditions, you know, whether public or private. But this prison, you know, there are 1,500 inmates. There were roughly 25 guards on shift for a day. They're making $9 an hour. They have no motivation to do anything except clock in and clock out.
25 guards with how many inmates?
1,500. And they're during the 4 months that I was there, there were about 200 weapons found in the prison, which is, I think it was 23 times more than Angola prison, the maximum security prison in Louisiana. And there were very little services. Services had been cut over the years, meaning rehabilitative programs, vocational programs, which led to a very frustrated population of inmates who wanted something to do with their lives while they were locked up. Many people did want to better themselves, which also, you know, it feeds this kind of cycle of violence. I one day sat on my first official day on the job. I sat on suicide watch, which kind of gave me a sense of the mental health options that prisoners have. There, in the whole prison of 1,500 inmates, there was one part-time psychiatrist and one full-time social worker. So, if a prisoner is having mental health issues, having a breakdown, often there's nobody there to see him. And so the only option he has is to go on suicide watch. If he says he is suicidal, the prison has to put him on suicide watch, which is solitary confinement. He will have no clothing. He'll only have a tear-proof blanket, no mattress, no books, nothing in the cell. And he sits there, and a guard sits and watches him for 24 hours a day. So I sat for 12 hours and watched a prisoner who his name was Damian Costley. He had threatened – he didn't want me sitting there and watching him. You know, he didn't want a guard sitting in front of him the whole time. He threatened if I didn't leave, he would break his neck, which I reported. A psychiatrist came some 6 hours later. And by the way, the people on suicide watch are fed worse food than the other prisoners. They get a little lunch bag that the caloric value of which is below USDA standards. Months later, after I left the prison, I was contacted by Damien's mother, who told me that Damien had committed suicide. Mm-hmm. He had been on suicide watch many times. She let me look through his files, which showed that he had been on hunger strike many times, demanding that the company provide real mental health services, and they didn't, and he committed suicide. When he died, he weighed 71 pounds. He hanged himself and was in a coma and sent to the hospital in a coma. And I later did a records request with the state of Louisiana asking them how many people committed suicide in that prison that year, and they said zero. Now, the company says that its rate of suicide is lower than it is in public prisons. And what happened in Damien's case is the warden granted him a compassionate release when he was in a coma, released from the prison. So when he died, he was technically not in the custody of the company, so they kept it off the books.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Shane Bauer. He went undercover for 4 months in a medium security prison in Louisiana. And he's the author of a new book, American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. We're just starting to get into the conditions that Shane found at the prison. And we want to hear your questions for Shane, 866-798-8255. The racial makeup of the prison and how race figures into this whole thing. And how being behind bars, even as a guard, affected Shane himself. We'll talk about all that and invite your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
This is Your Call on KALW Local Public Radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or would like to contribute to the conversation, please join by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email, yourcall@klw.org, or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org. Or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Coming up at 11, it's 1A with Joshua Johnson, a further dissection of the week's news heading your way at 1A. And at 2 o'clock, it's the BBC Real Story.
Welcome back. For those of you just joining us, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call. We are podcasting the show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there, and you can also sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up on the air next. And if you have a show idea for us, please drop us a line at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or, of course, give us a call, 866-798-8255. Or feel free to go to the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up on Monday on Your Call, there is a pattern of the federal government and the Trump administration in particular ignoring or diminishing scientific research. Recently, the EPA decided to eliminate their chief science advisor. They're now having open discussions about whether it might be healthy to have a little radiation in your life. And a new UN report about climate change is calling for rapid, far-reaching action to reduce carbon emissions. But the State Department of the United States says it does not it's just not going to endorse those findings. So coming up on Monday on Your Call, we're going to talk about what is fueling this disdain for science. That's Monday on Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Today, we are talking with award-winning Mother Jones senior reporter Shane Bauer. He's author of American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. In 2014, he went undercover at the Wynn Correctional Facility in Louisiana. He voluntarily took the earrings out of his ears and kind of put away the California part of his personality and went deep into the woods where this facility was located. He took this $9 an hour job in a private prison as a guard, and he used an undercover little notebook and a pen, an ink pen that doubled as a recorder, and his watch to take pictures, and with all those little items was able to chronicle a situation that many would find absolutely barbaric. And in it, he also, in the book, intersperses his story with just how brutal and long the history of prisons is in America. And we invite you to give us a call. 866-798-8255 is the number. Have you ever been incarcerated behind bars? What do you think of the recent prison reform movement? Has it made any difference at all? 866-798-8255 is the number. Shane Bauer, what was the racial makeup at Wynn?
It was about 75% African-American and 25% white.
And to what extent was that a surprise to you? And how did that impact how inmates perhaps were treated, if at all?
It was not a surprise to me. It's well known that African Americans are much more highly represented in prisons than white Americans. I will say that the guards also were mostly African American. They were also mostly women. Guards tended to be people from the town. The town was very poor. It was people that were desperate for jobs. There were a lot of single moms who were there because they needed, just health insurance for their children. I don't know how the racial makeup impacted the treatment of prisoners per se. I assume this breakdown was similar across prisons in Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Racial makeup of prisons has a long history that reaches back to the time of slavery. I write about this a lot in my book. I specifically focus on the kind of the for-profit dimension of this, and the ways that prisons, really going back to the American Revolution, were intended to turn a profit, really just until very recently. And particularly in the South, after the Civil War, was a particularly brutal phase in prisons, where the prison systems throughout the South were all privatized. They were companies, whether they were coal companies, railroad companies, or just planters, would use lease the prisoners from the states and put them to work, essentially filling the role that slaves had filled before the Civil War. So prisoners could be, you know, forced to pick cotton at a, you know, fast pace, driven by the whip. Coal miners would be tortured if they didn't, you know, mine enough coal. And this system of convict leasing was actually more deadly than slavery was.
You call it convict leasing.
Yeah. Mm. For the decades after the Civil War, the annual average death rate of convict leasing, depending on the state, was ranged from 16% to 25% per year. This is
one out of four prisoners.
Yeah. This is roughly on par with the death rate of the Soviet gulags. Mm. And even after this system ended in the 20th century, states essentially continued the same system, but in a public way. So states bought plantations. They forced inmates to work from dawn to dusk on the plantations. They continued to whip prisoners and torture them in other ways. And they were running these plantations at a profit, but the money would go directly into the state treasuries. And even in Arkansas until 1967, they used the whip. And it was this system actually has a direct connection to the creation of modern-day private prisons, because the co-founder of CCA started his career as the warden of a prison plantation in Texas that was the size of Manhattan, where prisoners were forced to pick cotton. He lived on the plantation with his family. He had houseboys, as they called them, which were prisoners who were almost always black, who served him and his family on the plantation. He would be condemned by federal judges for torturing prisoners, putting prisoners naked in solitary confinement who refused to labor in the fields. And he was really the last person to run a public prison at a profit. This was in Arkansas in the 1970s.
And his name is?
Terrell-Don Hutto.
Hutto.
Mm-hmm. And so when he left the plantations, this was a time when the prison population in America was skyrocketing, and he was approached by a couple of businessmen who noticed his abilities of running prisoners at a profit, and they proposed that rather than making money from prison labor, they start a company in which the prisoners themselves are the commodities, and they founded the Corrections Corporation of America.
A brutal system and monetized for time immemorial, yeah, in our country. 866-798-8255. And Mary Louise in Palo Alto, thank you for being here. Go right ahead.
Well, thank you very much for this program. It is very important and informative. And so my point, it seems very small in all of this, but what it is that prisoners, as I understand it, have to pay a lot in order to make a telephone call. And there's many restrictions also with them making telephone calls. And I'm just wondering, that's just one more thing that telephone company, which one I don't know, makes a lot of money, and the prisoners have to suffer. So I thought if that could be brought out, I would appreciate hearing something about it.
Thanks, Mary Louise.
More than I already know.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. I remember there was a lawsuit because phone companies were charging an exorbitant amount,
yep,
for inmates to reach out. So it's punitive. It's designed to be, and you talked a little bit racially about the inmate profile, but fully a third of these inmates, one out of three, have mental health problems. One out of 10 have severe health problems. You talked about the inmate who ostensibly, because of diabetes, which might have been treatable, had lost limbs and, mm-hmm, and fingers, and about 25%, about a quarter, have IQs of less than 70.
Mm-hmm.
So what does that say to you about how a for-profit or maybe even public institutions are corralling a particular demographic of people. They're black and brown, they tend to have health issues, and they tend to have low IQs. Does that tell you that there's a deliberate nature to this
Well,
process?
I think that this is actually representative of the prison population in general. The companies themselves don't choose who comes there. The judges send the Department of Corrections decides where a prisoner is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain ways in some states where the company has some choice. In California, for example, the company has worked into its contract that it will not accept prisoners with severe medical conditions because they cost a lot of money. And this goes into the question of how much do these companies actually save, because, if the private prison companies are not taking these high-cost inmates, that cost is going back onto the taxpayers. So there's all these kind of invisible costs. Also, counties, when they're vying for contracts to build prisons, will often offer many subsidies to these companies. So that's another hidden cost by taxpayers. But to touch on the phone issue, this also touches on the recent prison strike that happened. There was a nationwide strike inside prisons across the country. And one of their complaints, one of their demands, I should say, was immediate end to prison slavery. And what they meant by that was the labor that prisoners do, which is either unpaid or is paid at cents on the dollar, 15, 25 cents per dollar. Now, this labor it's not like the labor, 50 years ago when all prisoners were forced to labor. Generally now, prisoners are competing for jobs in prisons. So the prisons will say this is voluntary, they're not required to do this. But when you are a prisoner, especially if you're somebody who's been in for a long time and you don't have anyone outside putting money in your commissary, you often need to buy food if the food in the prison is bad. Some prisons people have to buy just basic things like soap and toothbrushes. You are going and you want to make phone calls. You want to talk to people on the outside, and these phone call rates are exorbitant. You are going to be compelled to work a job for 15 cents an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So the question of how voluntary this is, it's not clear.
We're talking to Shane Bauer. 866-798-8255 is the number. Let's go to Albert in San Francisco. Hi, thanks for being there, Albert.
Hello. How are you? Can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes, as part of my graduate thesis, I studied the private prisons in California specifically, and I just wanted to expound upon some things that Shane had said, and this is specific to California. The private prisons they're cash cows. Here, at least, they're getting paid on both sides. So not only is the state of California paying, Correction Corporations of America and GeoCorp per inmate to house them, but they're also contracting out the labor to private companies. So they're getting a revenue stream on both sides. In California as well, what they did, the private prisons, they actually made these videos, propaganda videos, which they would play in the government state prisons, in which inmates could apply to be transferred to the private prisons, in which they're interviewing inmates at these private prisons who say how great it is there, how much better it is there. They get paid a little bit more for their work. The other thing I wanted to touch on is the executives for these private prisons are constantly lobbying for tougher penalties, more laws on the books, because they need these inmates to come into their prisons in order to maintain their business. Now consider this. If we remove a father and a husband from a family and incarcerate him, these lobbyists for these companies love that, because it disrupts the family dynamic. And now the son of that inmate or the daughter is more likely to be an offender, just as their father.
Or that sounds like blood. The makings for a great thesis, Albert. It's quite Machiavellian. If we lock up the father, take him away from the children, that means we may be able to count on another generation for revenue. That's a remarkable insight. Thanks for calling, Albert. Did you have any thoughts on that, Jane?
Well, this made me think of one of the main areas that these companies are lobbying right now is actually an immigrant detention. They have been lobbying for tougher laws around immigration, and they also happen to be this happens to be a kind of growth area for these companies. The private prison industry controls about 2/3 of immigrant detainees in this country right now. Immigrant detention is about 25% of CCA's revenue, and the Obama administration, towards the end of his administration, granted CCA a $1 billion no-bid contract for a family detention center in Texas. So, and also towards the end of the Obama administration, he actually announced that the federal government was not going to use private prisons anymore.
Right.
So when this happened, their stock price tanked. It fell by half.
Mm-hmm.
The day that Donald Trump was elected, it rose higher than any company in the stock market, likely because investors were expecting that Trump would be tougher on immigration. And now, you know, the stock price is, you know, it's doing better than it did before Obama's decision. And Jeff Sessions, right after Trump was inaugurated, rolled back the Obama-era decision to stop using private prison companies.
It's extraordinary. Next, let's go to Albert in San Francisco. Hi, Albert. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. Good morning.
Good morning.
After listening to your show, I'm just wondering what today's speaker would have to say about things that any of us can do that can be effective at arresting and reversing the conditions that we've been hearing about here. If you have anything to say about that. I have also one comment to make, and that's that I work in a volunteer literacy program teaching kids to read, and an alarming statistic that we learned at the outset was that 75% of the kids who do not read adequately by grade 3 wind up in the prison or the corrective system.
Okay. Thank you, Albert. So the first question was, what can be done to stem, especially given how opaque things are in these institutions, what can average folks do? And secondly, what about that school-to-prison pipeline?
Well, I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist, so my focus is writing on these things. But I do know that in the Bay Area, there are resources for people who want to do that kind of work. The Prison Activist Resource Center is a place that sends people to various organizations, depending on what they're interested in doing. And what was the second question?
Well, the school-to-prison pipeline, and what can people do if they're interested in this issue?
Yeah, I mean, the school-to-prison pipeline is a very complex issue. There were people in the prison that I was in who were in their 30s and 40s who had been in the system since they were teenagers. You know, this is a common problem throughout the country. But I would again just point people to looking into these organizations.
You know, in response to that question, you made a point of distancing yourself from it by saying, I'm a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But I also read in the book that you had some ethical concerns. You wrote, is it okay for me to participate in this prison process, mm-hmm. even if it's for the sake of reporting on what's happening there?
Yeah,
so,
absolutely.
How torn were you?
I was. I mean, I'm a former prisoner myself. So, you know, when I went in, I took the job as a guard as a way to get inside. That was the only way that I could think of to really get inside and observe day to day what was happening inside the prison. But I quickly found myself in situations that were uncomfortable. I remember finding a cell phone by a prisoner that a prisoner was hiding. And it was my job to take the phone. It's contraband in the prison. But as a prisoner, I would have done anything to get a cell phone, and I would have never snitched on another prisoner that had a cell phone. So it was, it felt many times like I was kind of betraying this part of myself. I think anybody who's been locked up has, on some level, a sympathy with other people who are locked up, even if they're for different reasons or they did different things. And I realized pretty quickly that if I was going to do that job, I had to really turn that part of myself off. And I did. And I saw myself becoming much more authoritarian and dealt with prisoners much more coldly and harshly. And I started to feel over time that the person that I was in the prison was very different from the person I was outside, and would often feel ashamed of the person that I was inside.
You mentioned in the book that when you ordered the inmates to take their hats off, for example, mm-hmm. that you kind of got a little surge of power, yeah. and that you kind of felt good about that, that they have to follow my orders. Did that part of the experience kind of surprise you?
Yeah, I mean, it's seductive having that kind of power and having all of these people kind of under your control, even though in my mind I was very critical of the system, there's still a kind of personal level. There's something that it hits on a deeper psychological level that is very hard to combat.
I'm reminded of that Stanford experiment where the students were divided into guards and inmates,
yeah.
and it had to end early because the guards were really taking on this persona of a person in power and causing their fellow students. They knew it was an experiment. They knew they were being observed, and something just took over, and they were forcing them to strip and taking away their mattresses and otherwise brutalizing their fellow students. So did you feel like you were that far? I mean, could you understand how people could be pulled into that?
Oh, absolutely. And I definitely related to that study and thought about it while I was there. But, you know, I'll say that I don't think it's as simple as that once people are in a position of guards, they just kind of there's something in them that becomes hungry for power. A lot of it is actually about fear. You know, I was in a unit every day of 350 prisoners, and there was one other guard on the floor with me.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any weapons. So you end up, I would say guards and prisoners both are playing a psychological game where you're fronting in a certain way and mm-hmm. figuring out how to convince the people around you that you aren't afraid, that you are in control. And that doing that act changes you and your behavior, and it's really in many ways an act of self-defense
and survival.
Yeah,
I would imagine. Let's go to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg. Thanks
Hello.
For joining us. Go right ahead.
Hello. I don't know if I missed this, but I'll just make it as brief as I can.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, if you addressed the what you feel is the ultimate function or the underlying function of not just the prison system, the penal system as a whole, the courts and the police, what ultimate function do you think they serve in the society?
Thanks, Greg. Do we need to have facilities? What should those facilities look like? Was there anything that you pulled out of that CCA experience that you thought was valuable? Like, does it matter that the inmate population and the guard population are racially similar? Did that factor in at all?
Well, what he makes me think of is just the exercise of doing the historical research really was illuminating. First of all, the penitentiaries were invented in the United States. You know, they have not always existed. We've had jails throughout human civilization, but jails were places that people would be held, you know, before trial, before they were punished. But this idea that the punishment itself is putting people in prison was started here. And from the very beginning, that idea was tied to the idea that states would make money from prisoners. Prisoners had a time before penitentiaries would be forced to labor in public, for example. And in the early days of the Republic, Benjamin Rush, who was a co-signatory of the Declaration of Independence, worried that punishing people by forcing them to labor publicly would actually harm American capitalism, because it would make regular laborers look down on the type of work that prisoners were forced to do. And he worried that people would then refuse that type of work. So he proposed creating a house of repentance, where the prisoners would still be forced to labor, but out of view of the public. So that was the very first prison. And in the coming decades, states built penitentiaries where they would, force prisoners to labor for private contractors. And a few decades in to the existence of the penitentiary, many states were debating whether to keep them. Many were saying that it was a failed experiment. They were not working. People were not being rehabilitated. And we should just throw it out. And what actually changed, what convinced them to keep it was a prison in New York called Auburn Penitentiary, where a captain said, okay, these prisons were not making money, and prisoners were constantly burning down wings of the prisons throughout the country. They were very chaotic. So he convinced the state to reinstitute the whip, which had been banned by the American Revolution. And he vowed to turn prisoners into what he called silent working machines. So prisoners then would labor from dawn to dusk in silence. Anyone caught shirking would be whipped. And they labored for private contractors. And that prison was the first to actually turn a profit to the state. So rather than throwing out this model that was not actually having the effect that it was meant to, states followed this new system and built prisons along those lines, where prisons were essentially factories, and prisoners would be bringing money to the state. So it didn't matter at that point whether people were being rehabilitated or not, because they were profitable.
I thought it was interesting that the Wynn Correctional Center was the name, not Wynn Prison, just Correctional Center. But we have about a minute left. I'm wondering, as we close, what you think may have changed as a result of your reporting or since your reporting. And one thing certainly is that CCA is now changed its name. It's called Core Civic. Mm-hmm. And what has that led to in the way of how this company is perceived now?
I mean, things changed after I wrote the article for Mother Jones, but I would not credit all these changes to that. There have been many different kind of ways that people have been bringing attention to these companies. But the Obama administration ended its use of private prisons. That was reversed, but certainly still on the table. The Core Civic now calls itself a government solutions company, but I don't think anybody is buying that there's anything that's changed.
An extraordinary experience. I think a lot of journalists would have been way too afraid to even try this. So congratulations, Shane Bauer, on your remarkable experience and the book, American Prison, A Reporter's Undercover Journey into the Business of Punishment. And thank you so much to the callers. If you want to listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, you can call Your Call. You can visit yourcallradio.org. Malia Hayrazizan produced today's show. Josh Wilner is the social media producer. Phil Hartman is the chief engineer. And David LaTulipe is the studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp. This is Your Call.